You are listening to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee, where your host is Dr. Janine James, Brother Quojo Robinson, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister D.D. Cotney. The program is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, and it airs on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Email them at SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. And I repeat, SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. All of their programs are archived. Just go to the website, www.timeforanawakening.com, use the search portal, and put in the keyword, elders.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring, ring with harmonies of liberty. Let our
We're poor, Ashe. We're poor to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge, Ashe.
Ashe.
We poor to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science, Ashe.
Okay.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who raised the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Monday civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, oh my God, oh Madre de Dios, who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour our shame. We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, stop, no more. We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths. We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names. Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, Hamer,
John Henry Clark, John Dr. G. Jackson, Muhammad. Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
I don't have any trouble admitting that I'm a racist. I think it's absurd to try to fight with that. I grew up in this society. I was conditioned by it. I think internally in my psyche, I've grounded and rooted those attitudes, and I see it in me all the time.
I don't like being a white man, and that's where I still am and working on it, because I know what I've done, what people like me have done.
Part of being white is just not in any way acknowledging what it means to be white.
I have a white skin, and that with that white skin comes along a whole mess of privileges that I have, and I don't ask for them, they just are there.
You have started to break the code of silence a little bit when you start talking about white people and you start talking about this stuff, and you find yourself suddenly all alone.
The family history, as I understand it, was really, you know, people coming to America as a way of searching for a better life and escaping poverty. And it has often seemed to me that that also meant...
You look good out there, baby! And I tell him, I said, brother, everybody winds up knocking me. He knocks me back down on my top of the top. Somebody say yeah. Take your hand back and forth like this. Everybody. You sitting in the first balcony too. Heavenly please. All over the auditorium tonight. All over the auditorium. Hallelujah. But he winds up knocking me.
Finley Medical Clinic. We serve uninsured, underinsured, and insured individuals. Open Monday through Thursday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Urgent care clinic Friday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Call for an appointment at 414-988-3079. Finley Medical Clinic is accepting new patients. Vaccines and screenings for uninsured, underinsured, and insured. Located at 10721 West Capitol Drive, Suite 110. Call our office for an appointment today at 414-988-3079.
You are listening to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee, where your host is Dr. Janine James, Brother Quojo Robinson, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister D.D. Conley. The program is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, and it airs on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Email them at SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. And I repeat, SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. All of their programs are archived. Just go to the website, www.timeforanawakening.com, use the search portal, and put in the keyword, elders.
Welcome, and this is the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee. Good evening. We are very happy to have you here with us today. And we're going to be talking today about something that I'm hoping to hear from those of you, because I'm just really, really perplexed. And I'm hoping that you can help to get me straight and get me understanding a little bit more about what has just happened here in Wisconsin. We're talking today about privilege or murder. Privilege or murder. And if you have been listening to the news, you have a pretty good idea that what we're talking about today is what has happened within our legal system related to the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse. But let me just go into the purpose of the Sankofa Council from our bylaws. The purpose of this organization is to use African principles of unity and cooperation to create a healing environment for our community. And that's what we're going to try to look at, some healing. And what have we just observed? My co-host today, we'll be welcoming Sister Afua Mayat. And she will be with us. We look for her momentarily. This event that took place this week brings to mind a subject for our ancestral profile. And it is relevant for me because I lived through this time in our history. These are stories that I heard over the television and radio. But I think that this may be a little diversion from our ancestral profile, but particularly relevant for this time in our history. And the subject today for our ancestral profile is Viola Gregg Liuzzo. And Viola Liuzzo was born April 11th, 1925. She was an American civil rights activist. In March of 1965, Liuzzo heeded the call of Martin Luther King Jr. and traveled from Detroit, Michigan to Selma, Alabama, in the wake of the Bloody Sunday attempt to march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Liuzzo participated in the successful Selma to Montgomery marches and helped with coordination and logistics. At the age of 39, while driving back from a trip shuttling fellow activists to the Montgomery Airport, she was fatally hit by shots fired from a pursuing car containing Ku Klux Klan members. Their names were Collie Wilkins, William Eaton, Eugene Thomas, and Gary Thomas Rowe, the last of whom was actually an undercover informant working for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Rowe testified that Wilkins had fired two shots into Liuzzo on the order of Thomas and was placed in the witness protection program by the FBI. In an effort to deflect attention from having employed Roy as a informant, the FBI produced disinformation for politicians and the press, stating that Luiso was a member of the Communist Party. She was a heroin addict and abandoned her 5 children to have sexual relationships with African Americans involved in the civil rights movement. Luiso's involvement in the civil rights movement was scrutinized, and she was condemned by various racist organizations. In 1983, Luiso's family filed a lawsuit against the FBI after learning about the FBI's activities, but that suit was later dismissed. In addition to other honors, Luiso's name is today inscribed on the Civil Rights Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama. Luiso was born, as I said, on April 11, 1925, in the small town of California, Pennsylvania. She was the elder daughter of Eva Wilson, a teacher, and Herbert Ernest Gregg, a coal miner and World War I veteran. The Gregg family moved to Detroit, Michigan, which was starkly segregated by race. There were tensions between whites and blacks that were very high there, and in the early 1940s saw violence and rioting. Witnesses were witnessing this horrific ordeal with a major motivator that influenced Viola's future civil rights work. In 1964, she began attending the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Detroit and joined the National Association of the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP. This is a white woman. A large part of Viola's activism, particularly with the NAACP, was due to her close friendship with an African-American woman, Sarah Evans, after initially meeting in a grocery store where Luiso worked as a cashier. The two kept in touch, and Evans eventually became Luiso's housekeeper while still maintaining a close, friendly relationship in which they shared similar views, including support for the civil rights movement. In the aftermath of Luiso's death, Evans would go on to become the permanent caretaker of Luiso's 5 young children. Luiso was so passionate, and she believed in the fight for civil rights, that she helped organize Detroit protests, attended civil rights conferences, and worked with the NAACP. She had a strong desire to make a difference on as large a scale as she could. In addition to actively supporting the civil rights movement, Luiso was also notable for her protest against Detroit's laws that allowed for students to more easily drop out of school. Her disagreement with that law led her to withdraw her own children from school in protest because she deliberately homeschooled them for 2 months. Luiso was arrested but did not waver. She pleaded guilty in court and was placed on probation. In Selma, in February of 1965, a night demonstration for voting rights at the Marion, Alabama courthouse turned violent. State troopers clubbed marchers and beat and shot a 26-year-old African-American named Jimmy Lee Jackson, who later died. His death spurned the fight for civil rights in Selma, Alabama. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, scheduled a protest march for Sunday, March 7, 1965. Governor George Wallace banned the march, but the ban was ignored. 600 marchers headed for the arched Edmund Pettus Bridge that crossed the Alabama River. As the protesters reached the crest of the bridge, they saw a terrifying sight on the other side. State troopers armed with clubs, whips, and tear gas, and a sheriff's posse on horseback. When told to stop and disperse, the marchers refused. The troopers advanced on the marchers, clubbing and whipping them, fracturing bones, gashing heads. 17 people were hospitalized on that day, later called Bloody Sunday. There are many events that go along with this story of Bloody Sunday, but Luiso was horrified by the images of this aborted march on Bloody Sunday. A second march took place on March 9th, and troopers, police, and marchers confronted each other at the county end of the bridge. But when the troopers stepped aside to let them pass, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. led the marchers back to the church. He was obeying a federal injunction while seeking protection from federal court for the march. That night, a white group beat and murdered civil rights activist James Reed, a Unitarian Universalist minister from Boston who had come to Selma to march with the second group. Many other clergy and sympathizers from across the country also gathered for the second march. And on March 16th, Luiso took part in a protest at Wayne State. She then called her husband to tell him she would be traveling to Selma after hearing the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. call for people of all faiths to come and help, saying that the struggle was everybody's fight. Leaving her children in the care of family and friends, she contacted the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, who took her on and tasked her with delivering aid to various locations, welcoming and recruiting volunteers and transporting volunteers and marchers to and from airports, bus terminals, and train stations, for which she volunteered the use of her own car. On March 21st, 1965, more than 3,000 people began the third march, including blacks, whites, doctors, nurses, working class people, priests, nuns, rabbis, homemakers, students, actors, and farmers. Many famous people participated, including Martin Luther King Jr., Ralph Bunche, Coretta Scott King, Ralph Abernathy, and Andrew Young. It took 5 days for the protesters to reach their goal. Luiso marched the first full day and returned to Selma for the night. That Wednesday, March 21st, she rejoined the march 4 miles from the end where a Night of Star celebration was held in the city of St. Jude with performances from many popular entertainers. Luiso would not survive. Despite the protesters' efforts calling for the march, Luiso met her end. After the third march concluded on March 25th, Luiso, assisted by Leroy Moten, a 19-year-old African-American, continued shuttling marchers and volunteers from Montgomery back to Selma in her car. Luiso was warned by a veteran of the SCLC, James Orange, that it was dangerous and that she should not go out to Montgomery. As they were driving along Route 80, a car tried to force them off the road. After dropping passengers in Selma, she and Moten headed back to Montgomery, Alabama. As they were getting gas at a local filling station, they were subject to abusive calls and racist scorn. When Liuzzo stopped at a red light, a car with four members of the local Ku Klux Klan, including FBI infiltrator Roe, pulled up alongside her. When they saw a white woman and a black man in a car together, they followed Liuzzo as she tried to outrun them. Overtaking this vehicle, they shot directly at Liuzzo, mortally wounding her twice in the head. The car veered into a ditch, crashing into a fence. Although Moten was covered with blood, the bullets missed him. He lay motionless. And when the Klansmen reached the car to check on the victims, after the Klansmen left, Moten began searching for help and eventually flagged down a truck driven by Reverend Leon Riley. Like Moten and Liuzzo, Riley was shuttling civil rights workers back to Selma. Liuzzo's funeral was held in Immaculate Heart of Mary Catholic Church on March 30th in Detroit, with many prominent members of both civil rights movements and government. I tell us this story because it is somewhat reminiscent of what we're seeing in 2001, where there was an outbreak of rioting that took place in Kenosha, Wisconsin, in August of 2020, last year, following the shooting of an unarmed man, Mr. Blake, who was injured, seven bullets that he was struck by, and he's been left paralyzed as a result of it. And there were people who came out during this outbreak, some from other states, and one of those from another state was 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse. And we're hearing some of this story. We're hearing more about the story of this young man who says that he was afraid for his life, even though he's carrying a serious weapon, and shoots one of the people in the crowd, stating that he was fearful of his life. He shot three people, two of which died and one has survived. We know of the court case that took place. We were waiting for several days for the verdict of the jury, who acquitted Mr. Kyle Rittenhouse on all counts, five counts, not guilty. Many of us are left wondering, asking the question, why? What's happening? What is the message here? As an elder, I think about what are some reasons that might explain this. Like others, are sympathetic. I am sympathetic that we have a young man who has made a really poor decision, who put himself in a place that he should not have put himself. And as a result, people have been injured and lost their lives. But we need to be, of course, concerned about the loss of life. There is no question about this. But what is the message? What is the message that we have to look at in terms of what does this say to us? What is the message that it says in terms of, is it a compassionate movement? Is that what we're saying, that this is a young person who's made a poor decision and he needs leniency and he needs forgiveness? I think about the parents, the family, the friends of the persons who lost their lives and were injured, like Viola Liuzzo, who felt a reason to be where they were as well and lost their lives. So I'm wondering, as are the Sankofa Council, wondering, what is the message here? We encourage you to share your thoughts, your ideas, so that we can get some understanding, please. And our number is 215-490-9832. We welcome your calls, your comments. Help us to get a better understanding about what has just happened and what does this mean moving forward for us. I see we have a call at 404-453-404-453. Please share with us your thoughts. Is our caller listening, or is our caller has some thoughts to share with us about what is it that has just happened to us here?
Yes, ma'am. How you doing?
Thank you so much for joining us this evening. This is the State Coastal Council. We're glad to have you here. You've heard what's been going on here in Wisconsin. What are you thinking about this?
Well, I'm a critical thinker. I might say something that make everybody think. Okay, number one, to me, I just found some information that the whole thing was a psyop to get people all upset. All right? And number one, when he supposedly shot them three people, the two that died, I don't know nobody that went to the funeral and saw them in the casket. And then the lawyer, supposedly for Kyle Rittenhouse, I saw an interview with him, and said they had a mock trial. Said they had a mock trial to see if they should put him on the stand. That's what he said this morning on the news show this morning. So number one, it's all about fear and getting us upset. Don't fall for nothing y'all see. Just question everything and everybody and come to your own conclusion. And don't let these people get y'all emotional, get us emotional, and we go on fear and upset, get you upset and say blah, 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 because it's all theater. And number two, it's all they stuck the code anyway. If it was true, they stuck the code. They know they weren't going to convict their own people, their little boy. So it's all a joke to me. So we just got to stay cool and watch all this stuff. And by all means, stay in the street. That's white folk business. Don't get upset. Just laugh at it. Look at the show. Get you some popcorn. Relax. And watch the show. I'm down here in Georgia. So I'm looking at, okay, they're going to have that trial the same time they're having Ahmaud Arbery the three devils that so-called killed Ahmaud Arbery at the same time. See, to me, that Rittenhouse thing was a distraction. And that's about all I got to add. I let somebody else talk because I know I threw a lot out there.
You hang in here with us, and we're glad you came on and share your thoughts. And Sister Afua, I know we're concerned about this issue, and you heard our listener from Atlanta, and tell us what you're thinking about this. I'm kind of clueless.
I'm numb. Good evening, Dr. Jane, and to all of the listeners of the Elders of Sankofa podcast. It's a pleasure to be with you all. I'm numb. I don't right now have any particular thoughts. I knew that the verdict would be what it is. I had a lot of questions about the leadership of the way the judge handled things. I was talking to my family about the jurors when the judge allowed Rittenhouse to choose his jurors by pulling those numbers. I said, we don't know what was in that inside of that Turner. It could have been specific numbers planted, and all the other pieces of paper were blank. That was my thought. Like, you know, so yeah, I'm not surprised. Why couldn't the gentlemen that were killed, and the gentleman that was shot and has lived could not be identified as victims? I just the whole gamut of it. It just, like I said, it left me numb.
Have you noticed, and maybe I missed it, and I think there's some suggestion, could there be a conspiracy from the standpoint of there not really being casualties? I've been surprised that we have not heard more from the family members of those who were injured and lost their lives.
I thought that was a valid point that that the caller made, because so true. I don't recall seeing anything locally in the news in regards to funeral services. Any discussion of planning of a memorial. I did see one of the girlfriends speak, but it is interesting of how you really didn't see any information or details as to what happened with the victims, except for the one that's still living and got a chance to testify. So that's when he said that, it was definitely a hum moment. Makes you wonder. Very valid point.
Well, Sister Fua, can you go and give us our sponsor message? And
yes, I can. But before doing that, also, I would like to remind everyone to mute your phones, to be aware that our mics are very sensitive and background sounds can be heard during the time of you speaking. Our sponsor is EDoc Advice. It is a website created to provide a place to go to get answers your health and medical concerns. The questions are answered by health professionals and those who are knowledgeable about helping you make decisions about your personal health that makes sense to you. So visit www.edoc, www.edoadvice.com. That's www.edoadvice.com.
Sister Fool, we have a new or additional sponsor, and that is the Findlay Clinic. And I am a little distracted myself today because I needed to go and see the Findlay Clinic. And the Findlay Clinic, I am glad to say, was open on Saturday because I needed a COVID test. A couple of weeks ago, I traveled with a group of my friends to Galena, Illinois, and we have all been vaccinated. We all tested before we left, and we were all negative. But since we've gotten back, some of us have felt a little under the weather, I guess you might say. Nothing too serious, like a cold and a little diarrhea, some not much of a taste. And so one of the members is having a procedure next week, and they were required to have a COVID test. And she wasn't concerned about getting the test at all and came back positive. So she called me this afternoon and said, my COVID test is positive. So I had to think about where I could go to get a COVID test. And I learned about the Findlay Clinic. I went there here in Milwaukee, and I was cheerfully met by their nurse practitioner, who gave me a rapid test, which I'm happy to say was negative, because I've been here in town hugging and kissing grandbabies, which I haven't in quite some time. And so I was kind of in a panic. Had it not been for Findlay Clinic that was open today, whose friendly nurse practitioner saw me, gave me the test, which was negative, but they've also done the PCR, polymerase chain reaction test. This is the one that takes a little longer to process. So we did this one as well to make sure that, in fact, I am negative for COVID. But I wasn't able to really concentrate really well as I would like to have today had I not been able to get that testing. So COVID continues to be an issue for us, and unfortunately it has not been as easy a journey for people to get tested, as well as sometimes to receive the vaccination. Even though there's a lot of information that's out, it's not so accurate, because I've tried a couple of places in Chicago this past week and couldn't get a COVID test. And in fact, I was given an appointment for November the 30th to be tested.
Oh, no.
So that would mean I'd be walking around positive if I am, because I couldn't get tested. But I did get tested at the Findlay Clinic today, and I'm just real grateful to them, and I thank them for being open and making that possible. And tomorrow they'll let me know about other test that is done so that I know whether there's COVID there or not.
Wonderful.
So I just wanted to share that little piece in my life that was going on. And
I'm glad that we're proud to have Findlay as one of our sponsors and welcome them. And I'm glad to hear that your rapid test came back positive
negative.
I mean, there you go. Thank you for that correction. I always sometimes get that twisted of thinking positive meaning a good thing, but yeah. came back negative, meaning that there was no results finding that any of the virus was in your system. So that's a great thing.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for that. Thank you for correcting me on that, because I'm a civilian out here, so sometimes that medical terminology can flip you around. And I put in the atmosphere, in the space, that your PCR comes back negative as well.
Absolutely. So, well, it's time for a top of the hour. We're going to be going to that. And we're going to come back if there are callers who want to share what your thoughts are. Sister Afua and I are numb. We're scratching our head, and we want to hear from you. Our number is 215-490-9832. And if you want to share an email with us at sankofacouncilmke@gmail.com. So we're going to the top of the hour, and we will be back with you shortly.
When the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh, glory,
glory, glory.
Oh.
The heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, the spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots be on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be
every man, woman, and child. Even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles. From dark roads, heroes, to become a hero. Facing the League of Justice, his power was the people. Enemy is lethal, a king became regal. Saw the face of Jim Crow under a bald ego. No one can win a war individually. It take the wisdom of the elders and young people's energy. Welcome to the story we call victory, the coming of the Lord. My eyes have seen the glory.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, glory,
glory,
oh,
glory.
Finley Medical Clinic. We serve uninsured, underinsured, and insured individuals. open Monday through Thursday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Urgent care clinic Friday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Call for an appointment at 414-988-3079. Finley Medical Clinic is accepting new patients. Vaccines and screenings for uninsured, underinsured, and insured. Located at 10721 West Capitol Drive, Suite 110. Call our office for an appointment today at 414-988-3079.
You are listening to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee, where your host is Dr. Janine James, Brother Quojo Robinson, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister D.D. Cotney. The program is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, and it airs on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Email them at Sankofa Council MKE at gmail.com. And I repeat, Sankofa Council MKE at gmail.com. All of their programs are archived. Just go to the website www.timeforanawakening.com, use the search portal, and put in the keyword elder.
Welcome back. This is the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee and Dr. Janine James and Sister Afua Maat. We are here with you today talking about privilege or murder. And we're asking the question, what happened? What is going on? We're in our state, and we have just seen something. Sister Fua, you said you're not surprised about the verdict, but I, quite frankly, I'm surprised because I just cannot imagine being able to shoot and kill someone and be not guilty. I'm just not understanding that. I'm thinking about all of the young people who have had problems with the judicial system, who have done things far less serious as the taking of a life, and they are in jail. They're doing hard time. Their lives are being just messed up. And what is it that we're saying? And I'm thinking more about the point that our listener from Atlanta brought up that makes me wonder, is this an effort to bait us into a violent response? I think those who might be thinking maybe numb like you, Sister Afua, and not quite knowing what's going on. What does all of this mean? Does that mean that our neighbors, our coworkers, can decide that they are threatened by us and they can shoot us and kill us? And that's the end of that story.
Well, that's been going on.
I'm just not sure.
Yeah, that's the color of I feel fearful of my life. If you remember Trayvon Martin, so to me, it's a repeat of that, except for the victims are not like us. You know, they don't live in the skin of the melon skin. Yet they had no weapons. well, if you want to call a skateboard a weapon, but that was with the second victim that went after him. I don't even like to even say his name, because that gives energy to this person. So I would say the shooter, after he shot the first victim, who they have identified as throwing a plastic bag at him. And then after he shot the first victim, the second gentleman was going after him and had a skateboard in his hand. The third one, who is living, he pulled the weapon, but he didn't fight. So after he pulled his weapon, that's when he got shot. I did hear, I don't know how true, but rumor is that there was actually a fourth victim who has decided not to come forth. But when I didn't watch the trial day to day, but the little bits and pieces that I did hear, I thought that the trial lacked transparency. Again, with how did he get a chance to pull the jurors by paper? The prosecution, I think they were weak. The case, to me, should have been or could have been stronger. The questions that I had was, why was he running up and down the street with this weapon when he was supposed to be, as he identified, that there was a caller who owned a property, a business down there, and he asked for protection. So why wasn't he at that location? Now, it's different if, you know, the victims came to that location and, you know, and a big scuffle happened or something like that. But he was going up and down the street. So he wasn't even in the area that supposedly he was supposed to be, you know, securing. So I just have a lot of questions. And I'd never heard them bring that up during the trial. With all the snippets that I listened to, I still never heard anybody mention any of that. So I just think, like I said, it was in the fix. I believe it was in the fix. And the judge was, in my opinion, had the defendant been definitely a person of color, that case wouldn't have gone that way.
Well, that certainly is what many people are saying in terms of what our experience has been, that the verdict would not have been anywhere the same if you change the characters in this very tragic story, that the whole result would have been very different. And I think it's very interesting, as we has been pointed out to us earlier, about the fact that there is another high power case that's coming up. And this is Mr. Aubrey in Brunswick, Georgia, who also lost his life, not under the same circumstances. Mm-hmm. But I find that even the headlines have difficulty in writing the headline stating that he was, if not, say, murdered, was certainly killed by these three men who also say they feared for their lives, where there was no weapon, and we even have video footage that simply shows him looking in looking at a house, looking inside, which many of us, I'm sure, have done. I know I've done it, looked into a house. I never would have thought that as a result of having done so, I could have not only lost my life, but then the persons who admittedly who are responsible have a good chance that they may be not convicted and may be also acquitted in this circumstance. So it's kind of a curious time. And yes, is the goal to make us afraid? Well, it does make you wonder. I would say that. Our caller at 404-453, do you have anything else you wanted to share with us on this subject? Because I know you had some great thoughts.
Yes, ma'am. Concerning Ahmaud Arbery. See, I'm an electrician, and I'm in the union, IBEW. So I kept wondering what was he looking at in them houses. And I just found out a couple of days ago that he wanted to be an electrician, and that's what he was looking at, the wire, and that's really hurt me. That's what he, like you said, I mean, I done this a long time ago, looking at, you know, construction and going in a house, looking, and you did it too. We all did it. But like my sister said earlier, our word is our magic wand. So I'm looking to get retribution, and they got to pay for what they did, because that's the way the universe works. For every action, equal an opposite reaction. So if they kill, they got to be killed. I mean, it is like that. I mean, it is what it is. So hopefully we put that in the atmosphere. We get retribution and reciprocity. That's what it's all about. We're in a day of judgment now. So I'm a good thing that nothing is private no more. So everything is out there now. In the other day, see, they wasn't number slave catchers. Because, see, you remember when we was a slave, they said the Irish was always the citizens on patrol. The cop that was catching runaway slaves, and they Irish, their name was McMichaels. So they were doing what was in their DNA. Cause see, Georgia was a penal colony when so-called England sent their prisoners, their criminals over here in Georgia. Okay. So it's in their DNA to think they can get away with it, but not this time. Not this time. They will not get away. So I'm putting that in the universe. Like my sister say, our words are magic wand. So when we think it and say it, it's going to happen. So I'm going to leave it like that. Because if I'd have known that he was wanted to be an electrician, and I'd have found out, I went to the union meeting, and I'd have told all my brothers and sisters, and we probably could have mobilized to go down there. But we just had a union meeting last week. Hopefully the universe going to go, the ancestors with us, see. That's what our ancestors waiting us to do, to call them up. But they sitting around not doing nothing. So you call up the ancestors, they'll tell you what to do when they with us. But that's who told me exactly that, what he wanted to be an electrician. But I waited to confirm it from his mom and them. And that's what they said. But the universe, our ancestors with us, y'all. They waiting on us to call them up. Your ancestors, our ancestors, they waiting. So I'm going to leave it like that. That's food for thought.
I say, so true. He touched on a very valid point of during enslavement time. Mississippi was also a prison colony as well, and how they would be out on the prowl looking for us, and it's still happening to this day. Like I said, that's the number one phrase of I fear for my life. And you can be an average citizen or law enforcement, and as long as you have, from what I see, my perspective right now is, as long as you have that white skin, that's all you have to That's all you have to say. It will be interesting to see what happens with the upcoming verdict of this case. Now, to me, the prosecutor for the Alma case, she's putting in some work. She's definitely, you know, catching some of the testimony that they're giving. So I see work in hers. When it came to our local case recently, I didn't see quite the passion that I see in the one that's happening in Georgia. So to me, that makes a difference. I think they kind of worked together, and they had to put on the show here in Wisconsin. And now what I'm fearful of, what I'm concerned, highly concerned about is what this verdict sets the tone for others who are now feel that they'll be able to walk around with a high-powered rifle in Wisconsin, because they talk about the statute which allows minors to be able to carry, but it's only supposed to be for hunting. And every time I kept hearing that, I'm thinking, so he was allowed to be out here in the prowl hunting human life? He wasn't hunting. You know, this was during a protest. So it wasn't, you know, a hunting season for animals. So I just have a big issue with that. And they're talking about how we need to change the legislation here regarding firearms. So that's something to look into.
That's thank you so much for those thoughts. We have a call, 225-288. Do you have a comment and help us to understand the Sankofa Council looking for some ideas about what's happening?
Well, I'm unfortunately, I just tuned in, and I don't necessarily know. Sounds like you're talking about the verdict recently.
Right, Rittenhouse. We're trying to figure out how did they come up with this not guilty on all five charges.
Oh, well, the verdict itself was reasonable given what the judge had done. I mean, if you look at there were two elements. One, when the judge was able to dismiss the curfew and the carrying the weapon charge, you know, those misdemeanor charges. What that did is that took away the prosecution's argument about, him being an active shooter and an active menace. And so now the prosecutor, he had to prove that Rittenhouse was, was claiming self-defense. So the prosecutor had to prove that that he had provoked everything that happened to him. Well, the only way the prosecutor could prove that was through this satellite imagery that he had. But what the judge did is he said, well, when you blow up satellite imagery, that's unreliable. Well, if you give me a satellite image that I can't make out, in other words, what the prosecutor had to do is he had to show that he had to show that he was pointing the gun, because once he shows that he was pointing the gun, then at that point he no longer had his self-defense claim, right? And so, but the only way you could see that he was pointing the gun was if you blew up the image. But the judge ruled out the ability to blow up the image. So immediately now, if you give me that set of facts and you put it in front of a jury, even if I'm the most pro-black jury in the world, I'm still going to say fairness says that I don't have I can't, beyond a reasonable doubt, say that this man was being aggressive. And in fact, when the prosecutor, are you still there?
Yes, we're here.
Right. Oh, okay. And so when you looked at the prosecutor's witnesses, he brings on three witnesses, and each of those witnesses confirm the defense's story. You know, when he says that, you know, hey, he didn't point, because see, the argument was that, you know, Rittendahl or whatever, he was a menace. And so the prosecutor brings on witnesses that say, well, no, he wasn't pointing no gun at me. He didn't point at me until I pointed it. He didn't shoot me until I pointed a gun at him. Right. I mean, all of these things contradict the idea that this is some active shooter, you know, and whatnot. So to me, I think the combination of the fact that the judge obviously saw him as his grandson, and also I think the prosecutor really didn't put his back into it, you know, just like the opposite of what you were just saying about in Georgia, where now you had the fellow just testified that he wasn't under threat when they asked him, well, were you under threat, you know, as he was running, when, at what point were you under threat? And he pointed out that, you know, at no point, you know, was he there. Well, it was the opposite for Wisconsin. So it was a situation. In fact, I think the best comment was the contrast between what Joe Biden said and what Kamala Harris said. Joe Biden says, looking at it just from a legalistic point of view, that, you know, the law, you know, prevailed or whatever. And yeah, that's true from a legalistic point of view, the law did prevail. But Kamala Harris says, yeah, well, what this shows is that we got some work to do. Because it ought not to be the case that a person can be able to succeed in doing what he did.
Well, that those are some good points that you're sharing with us. And I want you to hang in there with us as we continue this discussion. One of our other Sankofa hosts, Brother Kwazi, I see is here. Brother Kwazi, what do you think about what's going on here?
Well, I tell you, it has nothing to do with the logistics in regards to what's right and what's wrong. It has everything to do with the hate that they have for the black and brown people and how you discipline white people for raising their arms up against other white people on the behalf of black people. You had a similar situation with the same defense attorney with, I can't think of his name offhand, but it was a black male that was defending himself. Somebody was trying to headshot some people and tried to steal his car, and he was defending his property with Rittenhauer. Rittenhouse was, you can't use deadly force to defend property. But that wasn't the issue at all. The issue was self-defense. And like they said, he can defend himself, but the prosecution made a weaker argument when it came down to what led up to being an active shooter. The other, the two young men that were killed, one of them had the skateboard, and the other one that was shot, I think he was armed with a gun, but he didn't pull his gun out to shoot. He didn't want to engage that way. But, I was working the protest, and I saw the extreme difference with how law enforcement and the antagonists that showed up at the rallies. You had that couple
the lawyer and his wife that I think they were out of Atlanta that pointed guns at the protesters. They came there pretty much every day.
Right. They were from St. Louis.
St. Louis. Okay. Mm-hmm. They came there. They came there every day. Just to walk around and take pictures. And actually, one of the ladies, and I videotaped it, one of the persons that he took a picture with was one of the councilmen from Kenosha. And then they were making the white power sign. You know, so this was out in front of everybody's news cameras, crews, and, you know, you had, you know, thousands of people out there. But again, you had your antagonists. And a lot of our people that were out there, and when I say that, like Bon Mays, he's a community activist, and he broke up a lot of fights that were out there. There was a guy out there, a white male. He was yelling Black Lives is a terrorist group, and they protect pedophiles. And he even pushed a young lady. And he was there the other day with the AR-15. And what the police told him, they asked him to leave because he was within 1,000 feet of a school. And I don't think that a black male would have got that same type of consideration and conversation under those circumstances. So it was kind of ugly out there with a lot of things that was going on there. But it's no surprise when you talk about self-defense, you saw one thing that Rittenhouse didn't do, he didn't point his gun until he was ready to shoot. So he kept his gun, you know, at 6 o'clock. So either you got it at 6 o'clock or you got it at 12 o'clock. And that's basically the way he kept it, you know, pointing downward or it's going to be pointed upward, up in the sky. And when he did have it any other way, he was in combat. And so that's what they basically looked at. And they just didn't make a strong enough argument in regards to the active shooter situation that people were chasing and trying to stop this active shooter because he had already killed somebody. They that didn't play out until maybe a month before the trial. But prior to the trial, they had all this other information. They knew that he had shot somebody first, but all they talked about was the self-defense aspect of this trial and showed the images of somebody attacking him with a skateboard and somebody kicking at him. And the guy that was kicking at him, I think he got locked up for assault on Rittenhouse. And of course, you know what happened to the other one. You know, other guy was shot and killed, and other guy lost part of his arm. And so, I mean, two people were dead. He shot several shots. So where those other shots landed, we don't know.
Oh, and by the way, there was another element that made the self-defense claim more feasible. The fact that the judge, once again, the judge basically, you know, determined, you know, how this case was going to go. But by him basically ruling out, not making admissible the state of mind of Rittenhouse before the event or the state of mind of him after the event, these are things that would give the jury a sense of what kind of person that we're dealing with. But by them only focusing on those narrow, you know, that narrow window within which, you know, there was shooting going on, that gave a person, you know, the impression that, hey, well, you know, this isn't a guy that's coming here, you know, to do mayhem, but rather, you know, this is an otherwise responsible individual. So you know, we've got some serious problems. But let me just suggest to you one of the things. Oh, you know, most of the audience here is black, and so most of us know how to play spades. And we know about people who, you know, when we ask them what do they have, they're not good at playing spades, and they can only determine how many books they can win based upon, you know, the power of the cards they have in their hand. the people who are good at playing spades understand that it's not just the cards you have, but it's the way you play those cards that determines, you know, what you can do. Well, in general terms, what you're really talking about is the difference between looking at the world spiritually versus looking at the world materially. When you look at the world materially, you look at specifically what you have and what you don't have. When you look at the world spiritually, you look at what you can do with what you have. It's the difference between somebody that has a whole lot of clothes versus somebody that has a whole lot of style. It's the difference between somebody having a whole lot of ingredients versus somebody having a recipe and a process. And so the problem that we've had in the past is that the leadership that we've had, let's be specific, Joe Biden and this Build Back Better, this is a materialist analysis where he's basically saying that whether or not something is right or wrong depends upon what you can physically see. Whereas when we look spiritually, when we look in between the physical, that's where our real strength is. And so I'll put it another way. When Dr. King, when he said, you know, hey, I'm afraid that we might be integrating into a burning house, one of his solutions to that was what he called the transformation of values. Remember when he made the speech talking about racism, militarism, and materialism, right? Well, that materialism is the key thing, because it's that materialism, that's the problem that we have to move away from. And we have to realize that there are things other than the material that's available. And so I can go on, but there are other people that want to talk. But I want to say that our winning hand is to understand that that our superpower is spiritual. And it ain't got nothing to do with, you know, what Jedediah said to Hezekiah in the whatever. It has to do with just simple. Do you know how to cook? Versus do you have ingredients? And so what I'm saying is that's where our strength is. And right now, unfortunately, when we have people with these kind of banker economist mindsets, the kind of quantitative mindset, what that does is that diminishes what we can do with what our gifts are. But I'll let it go at that.
Well, we really, 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 really appreciate these comments that you're sharing with us, and it broadens to a great extent some of the things that are going on, have been going on, and I can say we can anticipate moving forward that are going to have us think about the history, but to think about where we are at this time and our response, our reactions to what it is that we are seeing, and not to be manipulated, but it is still a very curious circumstance that we are seeing.
Can I give you one concrete example of what I'm talking about?
Sure.
After the Virginia election, they interviewed Joe Biden about that election. And one of the things about the election in terms of the results was that the turnout of black people was higher, I believe, than it was in the 20s. In 2020, but also the turnout of whites for Trump was higher than it was, that he got these non-college whites to come out at a higher level. So they asked Joe Biden about what was going on. And so, you know, the materialist analysis says that, you know, the problem is there's too much wokeness and we need to stop talking about defund the police. And in other words, we need to stop talking about doing right. And we just need to be talking about who got power and who got might. Well, they asked Joe Biden, and Joe Biden says that, well, you know, I don't really think it's anything that I could have done to influence the Trump voter. Well, I want to remind you that, you know, the superpower that Donald Trump has was the fact that Donald Trump had this Twitter account that enabled him to communicate with people. Well, the superpower that a president has is his bully pulpit. So for Biden to say that he couldn't imagine anything he could have done to dissuade the Trump voter. Well, we know that's bogus because we can just look at what happened in 2018 when this pedophile in Alabama was going up against Doug Jones. They were able to essentially shame white people to not vote for the pedophile, and that's what enabled the Democrat to win the Senate in a red state. You saw the same thing happen in Georgia in 2020, where Perdue, he ended up losing, or he ended up tying John Ossoff because of the fact that there had been Trump had essentially used his pulpit to discourage, you know, the votes of whites. And so what I'm saying is that because of the fact that Joe Biden and his advisors have this kind of materialist kind of banker, analysis that says anything that you can't touch and feel, then you really ain't got it. Because he doesn't have a spiritual analysis, that means that he's not really playing his hand. He's doing the same thing that Barack Obama did. Barack Obama, if we talk about this in terms of spades, Barack Obama was given a Boston, and he got set. And the reason he got set is that his grandmother was a banker, and obviously all she was telling him was how to look at the world materialistically. His father was an economist, even though he didn't quite know his father very well. But what I'm saying, that's what's going on, is that the hand that we have, that the fundamental distinction between black and white people, and by the way, when I say white people, I mean the people like Trump who want to rule the world and whatnot. They believe that might makes right. The fundamental distinction between black people is that right makes might. The difference is that, in terms of analogy, if you look at food, if you think of the world the way white people, or that is these gangster whites think of the world, these fascists, these white supremacists, they would assume that the only people who can eat at the table is people big enough to get them some. Whereas if you think about the spiritual way, you say, well, look, anybody that ain't there, we need to save something for them, right? We need to, make a space for the little babies and so on. So I'm saying that's the difference. And the problem that we have right now is that the guys who are supposed to be fighting for us, instead of fighting for us, what they're doing is they're essentially using the same playbook that Trump is using. And you saw it in Virginia when instead of them defending critical race theory, they were given these technical arguments as if, I don't know what you're talking about. That's not taught in the school system. And, as if they were in some kind of courtroom, not realizing the difference between political arguments and legal arguments. But in any case.
You make some very valid points. And thank you for joining us and for sharing that. I love the way you have posed this theory to us, and also sharing a lot of that court information. You and Brother Kofi sounds like you were definitely watching the case and had quite an insight to share. So I do want to say I appreciate you for allowing us to hear what you had to say.
You're welcome. If that's appropriate.
Do we think that we are on a new horizon as it relates to the handling of legal issues? Or is this simply an example of legal experts using the law in a manner that serves to get their client off? They know the law.
Can I speak to that real tightly?
Yes.
There's a fundamental distinction between legal and moral. The whole idea of critical race theory says basically, how is it that generations after the Voting Rights Act and all of these civil rights laws, how is it that the inequality between black and white people persists? Well, the reason that the inequality persists is that legal is not moral. In fact, that's really the distinction between what Kamala Harris was saying and Joe Biden was saying. He looked at the Rittenhouse verdict and said legally that's the correct verdict that you can get. Kamala Harris looked at it morally and said clearly that verdict is not right. Now, of course, she couldn't say that, but she said, there's some stuff we need to do. And so that's the problem, is that, in fact, you saw it with the civil rights movement, with Charles Hamilton Houston at Howard, when, the idea that, when they started talking about what we need to do is we need to convert all of our activism and whatnot. We need to convert that into stuff you can take into the courtroom. Well, when you take stuff into the courtroom, the first thing that you're doing is you're putting all of the decision making into the hands of the handful of people who run the courtroom. And that's not you. But the second thing that you do, even more important than that, is you're guaranteeing that the terms of engagement are going to be materialist terms of engagement, not spiritual terms of engagement. In other words, what's right does not matter in a court of law. It's what's legal that matters. Now, as long as we play in a game about legalism, well, then the person who wins that game is the guy with the best lawyers or the most money to get the best lawyer. On the other hand, if we're playing the game at that spiritual level, now what's right is important. And it turns out that unlike people like Trump, he's a psychopath, so he's not going to be available to any kind of moral appeal. And those handful of people who Hillary Clinton was talking about with hiding under rocks, they're not going to be available to moral appeals. But most white people are available to moral appeals, but you got to make spiritual arguments to get there. And the problem with Joe Biden, basically trying to bribe, to give them, better infrastructure. By the way, that was a Build Back Better, basically, is taking Trump's argument that we need to have our airports is better than the Chinese. And Biden is basically getting ahead of Trump's argument. And so what there was a way that I was going to put that. But so the problem that we have is that I lost it because I went somewhere else and I can't get it back. But in any case, so that's what's going on. Our guys ain't playing their hand. That's the bottom line. And that but we got the winning hand because we've got the moral hand. And if you saw that prior to Trump is a psychopath. People wouldn't even have done what Trump did. In fact, they thought it was impossible to do what he did. But because he's a pimp, and I'd have to explain what that means. But most white people prior to Trump wouldn't have even attempted to do what he did, right? But we still have that hand, and the reason is that human beings want to do things that human beings do. They don't want to do things that machines do. And the only way that you can sustain the kind of momentum that, the Rittenhouse verdict implies is that you have to turn human beings into machines. And even though you might talk all this white people are lived in caves and they're inferior to us and whatnot, no, most white people are human beings. And they will do the things that human beings do, but you have to bring that out of them. That's what comedians do. That's what singers do. That's what epiphany is all about. But when you give these kind of materialist arguments about who's got the most guns or who's got the most people or who's got the most whatever, you're essentially you're not appealing to their heart, right? In other words, and by the way, the other thing about critical race theory fundamentally is that critical race theory is saying that it's not relevant what white people think about black people, what their personal feelings are about black people, that the problem in our society has to do with structural encumbrances. It's structures that produce the results that we have. And so the reason, in fact, if you remember Dr. King, when he said that, look, it was easy and it was cheap on white people to have public accommodations. That didn't cost them anything. In fact, they could even make money letting us into their hotels. But now that we go into that next level where we're talking about actual transformations of power, well, now that's what's going to be difficult. Well, that's exactly what's going on with critical race theory. Because when you start looking at the structures and the values that underlie a society, that's where you do heavy lifting in real social change. And that's why you're getting this kind of concerted activity to put a stop to it. And by the way, I'm going to end it with this. The battle that we're fighting now on the spiritual side of the battle is community. Dr. King called it the beloved community, but I would call it the sacred world. That Wakanda vision of how it is, how you can create a world that enable all people to cooperate and live in harmony with each other. On the other side, on the materialist side, there are three groups that we're fighting against, and we've been fighting against them since the Protestant Reformation, because the vision that they have is that they want to return back to the world. Remember the world before the Protestant Reformation where the Catholic Church ran everything. So the world they want is the world where so the community is on the one hand, and the community is fighting the church on the other hand. There's going to be a battle between the Catholic Church and the Protestants, and you saw National Security Advisor saying that there needs to be a unified church. Well, that means there needs to be a fight between the Catholics and the Protestants as to who's going to head that unified church. But so one group is the church, and the Catholics are dominant because they have stronger organization. The second group is the crown. Trump represents the crown. In other words, the ideal of somebody whose authority, the divine right of kings, that my authority doesn't come from my ability to do anything. My authority just comes from who I am. And then the third group is commerce, the capitalists, the people, you know, who make money. These are the people who are afraid of democracy, because if there's a democracy, those people will have to pay taxes. Those people will have to be regulated. Those people will no longer be able to rule the world, you know, the way they are. That's the fight that we're having right now. But unfortunately, our guys are not, our guys are not completely in the game. But I can go on and on and on, but y'all got other things. So let me just back up.
I appreciate that, thank you for bringing that energy. I've been taking notes as I've been listening, and it sounds like Dr. James that there's definitely some topics for some podcasts because we are almost close to the end of 2021 to continue in 2022.
Well, as you speak about that, it reminds me that we have something that we're getting ready for to prepare for the ending of 2021.
Yes, yes.
And that is something that Sankofa Council of Milwaukee has been talking about all year long. And that has been Kwanzaa.
Yes, the seven principles of Ubuntu.
The seven principles, yes. So we're getting ready for that celebration. And before we get ready for our wrap up, and I'd like to see if we've got a message again from our sponsor.
We do, and that is EDOC Advice. We provide specific medical answers to those seeking a better medical conditions and health. We offer our faculty of EDOCs, who are licensed physicians and health professionals who make themselves available to those globally seeking a better understanding of health issues and medical practice. EDOC can be reached at www.edocadvice.com. and that is www.edocadvic.com.
And we also have want to welcome anyone who has a book that they've written or a service they'd like to share with us, like the Finley Clinic, who would like to be a sponsor for the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee. We are looking for your contributions to the program, and we're looking for email messages if you have for us at Sankofa Council MKE@gmail.com. We are so blessed to have had our listeners here with us today on this subject to really reflect on what's going on, what our history has been, what the laws have been. And I am happy to see that we have not experienced the violent response. And again, I suspect that many of us are numb, are shocked, and we realize that there has been loss of life. But we've brought up several points that are most relevant to what's going on at this particular time, and I'm glad that we are thinking about those things. And perhaps as we look at our preparation for Kwanzaa and those seven Nguza Saba principles, it will allow us to move forward in a constructive fashion. Sister Afua, I know that you have had some experience with the Kwanzaa celebration. My experience has been limited, although I'm really looking forward to this being a practice for my family, since I have a new grandbaby. But can you share with us a little bit of your experience with the Kwanzaa celebration and what things maybe we need to be thinking about as we're getting closer to that time?
Yeah, I could. Kwanzaa is it's a celebration, but more of a cultural celebration. It's not about religion. There's no one talking about any form of religion at all. It is a celebration for the community to come together to embrace the African culture. There are 7 days of Kwanzaa that we celebrate, starting December the 26th. And we come together with a big community celebration on New Year's Day. There are various ways to celebrate Kwanzaa. We do start with libation, giving honor to our ancestors, to the future, the present, to those that are unborn. As we open with our podcast as well, as an example of that. And there are, each day, there are themes that are discussed as a community. Some celebrate Kwanzaa within their home. I personally love to be out in the community because you get, it's almost like a reunion. You get to see people you haven't seen. At least I haven't seen them. Usually I see them every year for Kwanzaa. And it starts off my year complete for me. The first day is Ijumaa, which is unity. Second is Kujichagulia, which is self-determination. Third day is Ijumaa, which is work together. Fourth is Ujima, which is support. Fifth is Nia, purpose. And our sixth is Kuumba, which is creativity. And then our seventh day with the large celebration is Imani, and that is faith. However, again, we do talk about faith, belief, not from a religious standpoint. So it would be great for people to come together. These 7 days are based on the Ulu Saba. And each day of Kwanzaa with those themes, those are things to talk about, like unity, you know, unity within our community. How can we unify more, come together more? Self-determination, what goals, what do you do? How can we determine more self-determination within our circle, within the family, within the community as a whole? So those are things to have discussion on. Our children, there are also gifts that our children receive. And so I don't want to give too much. It would be great for people to come together. It is, Kwanzaa is Swahili for the first fruit or the first harvest. And that's what Kwanzaa, the meaning of Kwanzaa is.
Well, Sister Fua, we've got a song that'll help remind us of that as we close. And we thank you for joining us today. I thank also the Sankofa Council for its support of this program and for sharing their vision for unity following Afrocentric principles and helping us to learn and use those principles in our lives. We look forward to bringing to you more programs that we hope you will enjoy. Visit our sponsors, Finley Clinic and www.edocadvice.com. Good night. Stay safe. This is Dr. Janine James and Sister Afua Maat, the Sankofa family, and all of you until next time.
Finley Medical Clinic. We serve uninsured, underinsured, and insured individuals. Open Monday through Thursday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Urgent care clinic Friday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Call for an appointment at 414-988-3079. Finley Medical Clinic is accepting new patients. Vaccines and screenings for uninsured, underinsured, and insured. Located at 10721 West Capitol Drive, Suite 110. Call our office for an appointment today at 414-988-3079.